Kaposi's sarcoma. In 1990, four leading scientists at the CDC suggested in The Lancet that Kaposi's sarcoma was common in young gay men who indisputably did not have HIV. They concluded that KS, the disease most central to the definition of AIDS, may be caused by an as-yet unidentified infectious agent transmitted mainly by sexual contact. This was a stunning development because KS was the initial and defining symptom of AIDS. Prior to 1981, KS was a disease limited to very old people. Its sudden appearance in young men was the identifying signal that launched the AIDS crisis. It was fundamental doctrine within the medical establishment that KS was the diagnostic signal of the AIDS pandemic. The very existence of AIDS was inextricably linked to KS. If HIV was not responsible for the outbreak of Kaposi's sarcoma, then there had to be another culprit. That insurmountable logic raised the question of whether paupers might also be causing the other symptoms of AIDS, particularly the other major manifestation, immunosuppression, which science also linked to amyl nitrite. While publicly cleaving to Dr. Fauci's official HIV/AIDS orthodoxy, Robert Gallo himself privately signaled doubts about his own theory that HIV alone can cause either Kaposi's sarcoma or AIDS. At a high-level meeting of U.S. health authorities in 1994 titled "Do Nitrites Act as a Cofactor in Kaposi's Sarcoma?", Gallo made some astonishing confessions to his trusted colleagues. HIV, he acknowledged, might only be a catalytic factor in Kaposi's. There must be something else involved. Then he added a breathtaking concession, which could have been taken from the very research in Duisberg's article. "I don't know if I made this point clear, but I think that everybody here knows we never found HIV DNA in tumor cells of KS, so this is not directly transforming. And in fact, we've never found HIV DNA in T cells, although we've only looked at a few. So in other words, we've never seen the role of HIV as a transforming virus in any way." One attendee of that meeting was Harry Haverkos, by then director of the AIDS Department at National Institute on Drug Abuse, NIDA. Haverkos observed to Gallo that not a single case of Kaposi's sarcoma had been reported among blood recipients where the donor had Kaposi's sarcoma. "If blood transfusions couldn't spread the disease," Haverkos said, "then semen exchanges could hardly be a plausible culprit." In response, Gallo allowed, "The nitrites, paupers, could be the primary factor." To fully appreciate the seismic implications of Gallo's statement, we must recall that in wealthy nations like the United States and Germany, Kaposi's sarcoma was, along with PCP, the signature disease for diagnosing patients with AIDS. In 1987, for example, Der Spiegel described AIDS patients as the sarcoma-covered skeletons from the same-sex scene. By 1990, government regulators were already scrambling to drop Kaposi's sarcoma from the AIDS definitions. At present, it is accepted, even by CDC scientists, that HIV plays no role, either directly or indirectly, in the causation of Kaposi's sarcoma, wrote Australian biologist and AIDS expert Eleni Papadopoulos in 2004. This was a momentous bait and switch. Kaposi's was the AIDS-defining illness. In the beginning, says Farber, AIDS was Kaposi's sarcoma. Because its association with AIDS was so well established, the official concession that the two conditions are distinct has never penetrated the reigning orthodoxy. Kaposi's sarcoma remains part of the official AIDS definition in industrialized countries. Anyone with KS and a positive test result counts as an AIDS patient. And contrary to the facts, mainstream media outlets like The New Yorker still report that Kaposi's sarcoma is a sign of AIDS, i.e., HIV causes KS. AZT as culprit. After 1987, Dr. Duesberg and his followers argue, the vast majority of AIDS deaths were actually caused by AZT, Dr. Fauci's radical antiretroviral chemotherapy purposefully concocted to kill human cells. Duesberg describes the syndrome as AIDS by AZT. Ironically, he argued AZT, the highly toxic medication that Dr. Fauci was prescribing to treat AIDS patients, actually does what the virus cannot, that is, it causes AIDS itself. In a rational universe populated by critical thinkers, Duesberg's suspicion that AZT causes immune collapse should never have seemed revelatory. The FDA, after all, had deemed AZT too toxic to use for even short-term cancer therapy. AZT is highly mutagenic, meaning that it destroys the genes themselves. It causes cancer in rodents. It targets the bone marrow where blood cells called lymphocytes are made. These are the very cells that an AIDS patient needs most for immunity. AZT randomly destroys bones, kidneys, livers, muscle tissue, the brain, and the central nervous system. Cancer patients typically take chemo drugs for only 2 weeks. Thanks to Tony Fauci's official study, doctors were now prescribing AZT for life. Chemotherapy, says Duesberg, is restricted to a few months. The hope is that the cancer dies before you die. Duesberg believes that AZT was not only causing AIDS, it was killing more people than had previously been dying from autoimmunity caused by recreational drugs. AZT is causing AIDS and it's defining diseases, he said. It doesn't cause Kaposi's sarcoma, but it does cause immune deficiency. It was designed to do that. In fact, the manufacturer says specifically that it can cause AIDS-like diseases. Burroughs welcomes insert warns that it is often difficult to distinguish adverse events possibly associated with administration of retrovir AZT from underlying signs of HIV disease or intercurrent illnesses. In other words, even the company acknowledges that AZT causes the diseases that define AIDS. If you start taking any other chemotherapeutic agent for the rest of your life, it would be that agent probably to kill you, Carrie Mullis observed. When you give chemotherapy to somebody with cancer, you give them a round of it for maybe 14 days or a few days. Hopefully you're not going to kill the patient. You're going to kill the cancer. Patient's going to survive. But you don't keep giving it to him until he dies, because he certainly will. Luc Montagnier makes this same point about HIV. Any drug active on HIV will be toxic because it's not 100% specific of the HIV enzymes. If Duesberg is right, AIDS is an iatrogenic, doctor-caused pandemic, and Dr. Fauci would be its author. It wouldn't be the first one. Historically, there are many examples of prescribed medicines causing worse injuries than their target disease. The notorious Tuskegee experiment, 1932-1973, which my uncle, Senator Ted Kennedy, exposed and ended in 1973, began as an effort by public health regulators to unravel which syphilis symptoms were from the spirochete bacterium and which were from the mercury cure that doctors had by then been prescribing for more than 500 years. As it turned out, the most deadly and debilitating symptom of syphilis, the lethal second-stage neuropathy, was actually acute mercury toxicity. Not surprising, since mercury is nature's most toxic substance. AIDS is a chronic long-term breakdown of the immune system that can be caused by multiple factors, says Mark Gabrish Conlon, gay historian and publisher. Generally, more than one of them operating within any particular person with AIDS or with what has been described as AIDS. And at the top of that, in the West, would be recreational drug use, also pharmaceutical drug use and repeated infections, including diseases that are genuinely sexually transmitted, repeated antibiotic treatments for these, a lifestyle that involves a lot of partying and lack of nutrition. In the less developed world, AIDS is primarily a disease of malnutrition, starvation, and the endemic infections that have been part of those environments for years. Doctors Duisberg, Wilner, and others believed that AZT killed tens of thousands of Americans between 1986 and 1996 before less toxic chemotherapy drugs were introduced, causing far more fatalities than the immune deficiencies associated with the recreational drugs during the first wave of the AIDS pandemic. A scientific study in the New England Journal of Medicine article in late July 1987 headlined "The Toxicity of Azithromycin, AZT, in the Treatment of Patients with AIDS and AIDS-Related Complex," and a comprehensive investigation by the Independent of London in May 1993, "The Rise and Fall of AZT," both supported Duisberg's theory that AZT was a deadly killer of dubious efficacy against amorphous AIDS. Rudolf Nureyev and Arthur Ashe. Rudolf Nureyev, greatest ballet dancer of all time, was friends with my parents. He visited our family home in the 1960s and 70s. Against his doctor's advice, he began taking AZT. Nureyev was HIV positive, but otherwise in robust health. His personal physician, Michel Kinesi, recognized the deadly effects of AZT and warned Nureyev not to take the drug. But Nureyev insisted, "I want that drug." He became sick soon after commencing treatment and died in Paris in 1993 at age 54. That year, former Wimbledon champion Arthur Ashe also died at age 49. Ashe was also a family friend and a regular fixture at our family home at Hickory Hill and Hyannis Port. A heterosexual, Ashe learned he was HIV positive in 1988. His doctor prescribed an extremely high AZT dose. In October 1992, Arthur wrote a column for the Washington Post, voicing his extreme misgivings about AZT. "The confusion for AIDS patients like me is that there is a growing school of thought that HIV may not be the sole cause of AIDS, and that standard treatments such as AZT actually make matters worse," Ashe acknowledged, adding, "there may very well be unknown cofactors, but the medical establishment is too rigid to change the direction of basic research and or clinical trials." Ashe wanted to stop taking AZT, but he didn't dare. "What will I tell my doctors?" he asked the New York Daily News. If Arthur Ashe's suspicions and Duisberg's suppositions are correct, Dr. Fauci would be the father of the AIDS pandemic and responsible for prolific deaths. So that story must never be found to be true. Is AZT mass murder? There is little question that the character of AIDS changed dramatically in the early 1990s with the proliferation of AZT. Kaposi's sarcoma uncoupled from the disease, and AIDS cases began to look increasingly like AZT poisoning. Then, at a certain point, when really that sort of AIDS virtually ceased to exist, there came a new type of AIDS, says John Lauritsen. So they expanded the definition, and also they began giving the anti-HIV drugs to people who were in fact not even sick, but merely positive on the HIV test. And in that case, of course, When they finally became sick enough from the AIDS drugs, they were called AIDS patients. I would simply have to say that my main concern is the gay men who have been murdered, Lauritsen observed. I don't think murder is too strong a word to use when you have a drug like AZT and all the nucleoside analogs that followed, more or less on its coattail, approved on the basis of fraudulent research, and where, as you know, Joseph Sonneben said, AZT is incompatible with life. Well, if it's incompatible with life, it's a poison. And if it's a poison that kills people in context like that, it is murder. Concurring with Sonneben's assessment, John Lauritsen accuses Dr. Fauci of conducting genocides against gay men and black Africans. The evidence seems to indicate that the proliferation of AZT increased death rates from AIDS dramatically. The annual mortalities from so-called AIDS during the early years of the pandemic for 1983 to 1987, prior to AZT's approval, were lower, perhaps 10 to 15,000 people in a country of 250 million. It wasn't until the late 1980s, when Dr. Fauci's AZT came along, that the number of deaths attributed to AIDS shot up. According to the CDC, in the fifth full year of AIDS, 1986, 12,205 people with AIDS died in the United States. At that time, CDC, in a now familiar scheme to stoke pandemic fears, used deceptive protocols to inflate the body counts. The CDC's mortality numbers include anyone with an HIV-positive antibody status, even if the deceased had no AIDS-defining illness and instead succumbed to suicide, a drug overdose, a car accident, or a heart attack. The death rate climbed precipitously after the commercial introduction of AZT. In 1987, AIDS deaths rose by 46%, with 16,469 people dying. In 1988, as more and more people received AZT, the death toll rose to 21,176, and then to 27,879 in 1989. Death rates rose to 31,694 in 1990 and 37,040 in 1991. At the end of the 1980s, HHS's standard prescription for AZT was 1,500 milligrams a day. In 1988, the average survival time for patients taking AZT was 4 months. Even mainstream medicine couldn't overlook the fact that the administration of higher doses led to much higher death rates. At the beginning of the 1990s, health officials lowered the daily dose to 500 milligrams. The average lifespan of AZT patients rose to 24 months in 1997 as deaths attributed to AIDS plummeted. Afterwards, CDC changed its counting metrics to make it difficult to count annual AIDS deaths. In his History of the Era, historian Terry Michaels wrote, "The CDC, for the years between about 1986 and 1996, created the illusion that tens of thousands in America died from AIDS or HIV in that decade, rather than AZT and other monotherapy nucleoside analog drugs." According to Dr. Klaus Kuhnlein, MD, a German internist and co-author of Virus Mania, most of the deaths attributed to AIDS or HIV disease, as eventually it would be called, from the mid-1980s to the mid-1990s, were the result of iatrogenic illness resulting from prescription of high-dose, toxic, DNA chain-terminating chemotherapy, specifically azithromycin, AZT, ending in premature death for scores of thousands of HIV-positive gay men, plus many hemophiliacs, IV drug users, sub-Saharan Africans, and a few heterosexuals, unlucky enough to have taken the specious HIV test, like the late tennis star Arthur Ashe, who died in 1993. Kuhnlein observes, "The treatment causes a very similar condition we would expect from an AIDS patient. That's why nobody noticed that there was something wrong with the treatment." The HIV dissent movement, propagandistically rendered the HIV denialist movement by the AIDS research establishment and media, was somewhat less under siege in Europe than in the United States. The HIV establishment was transnational, sparking and condemning as a unified globalist voice. However, in European countries where funding is less reliable upon Dr. Fauci's approval, dissenting professionals could generally keep working without intelligence to the state apparatus. Dr. Klaus Kuhnlein, an oncologist from Kiel, Germany, was less subject to the financial discipline by the state actors or the political hysteria that was censoring dissident scientists in the United States, and was in some ways more of a threat to the HIV propaganda juggernaut than even Peter Duisberg, as he spoke from direct clinical experience. Kuhnlein saw his first AIDS patients in 1990 and treated several hundred over the decades in his very conventional Kiel clinic. Ignoring HIV and instead treating each symptom, he got almost all of his patients out alive. "I lost maybe a handful," he said in an email when contacted for this book. His views on AZT were unequivocal. "We virtually killed a whole generation of AIDS patients without even noticing it, because the symptoms of the AZT intoxication were almost indistinguishable from AIDS," he said in one interview. He elucidated during an RT interview in 2010, during a Rethink conference in Vienna, "When I worked at the university in Kiel, I witnessed the mass intoxication of the patients with AZT. AZT was the first recommended treatment, and we all know today that the dosage was much too high. We gave 1,500 milligrams on a daily basis, and that literally killed everybody that took this treatment. That is the reason why everybody believes that HIV is a deadly virus, but there is still no proof of this assumption." The reporter was incredulous, so Kuhnlein elaborated. "They were all overtreated at that time, and the reason why doctors didn't notice it was easy to explain, because the placebo control was stopped after 4 months," he replied. "It was said that for ethical reasons, nobody can withhold AZT treatment. After these 4 months, the mortality rose tremendously in both groups. This mistreatment was the very reason why everybody believed HIV to be a deadly virus, and that HIV-positive tests put everybody at equal risk, which is completely nonsense. So a healthy pregnant mother today, an HIV-positive pregnant mother, is told she carries the same deadly virus as a hopeless IV drug addict." In an email, Kuhnlein pegged the evidence against both HIV theory and AZT to 3 studies. "Harm is usually underreported," he wrote. "To prove it, you need 3 studies. The AZT licensing Fischl study, the hemophiliac study in Nature, where editor John Maddox showed that the HIV-positive hemophiliacs started dying only the very year AZT was introduced, and lastly, the Concord Lancet study, which showed the more AZT, the more death." In his October 30, 2020 expose, The Other Media Blackout, Wall Street Journal columnist and editorial board member Holman W. Jenkins, Jr. complained that the medical community has failed to acknowledge complicity in poisoning hundreds of thousands of human beings. "The illness and death that resulted from high AZT doses administered in the 1980s and 1990s is irrefutable." "From my personal contacts with people in the field," says Dr. David Rasnick, Ph.D., an AIDS researcher, chemist, and designer of protease inhibitors, "I can tell you that I've found no evidence anywhere that people live longer, better lives who take these anti-HIV drugs, these protease inhibitors, either alone or in cocktails, as compared to a similar group of HIV-positive people who do not take these drugs. So I do not know where the evidence is for the claims that you see in the New York Times or on CNN or wherever you see it that people are living longer, better lives as a consequence of taking these drugs. Duesberg points out that the annual mortality rate of HIV positives undergoing antiviral therapy is 7 to 9%, far higher than the mortality rate of all HIV positives worldwide, at about 1 to 2% per year. Furthermore, there is ample evidence that treated HIV positives die much faster of liver failure or cardiac failure than both HIV-infected individuals and AIDS patients who do not take AZT. Gays join Dr. Fauci. In marshaling institutional resistance to dissent from the growing cadre of prominent scientists and doctors, Dr. Fauci found an unlikely ally, the AIDS community. Beginning after his 1987 reconciliation with Larry Kramer in Toronto, Dr. Fauci quickly moved to build financial bridges to gay leadership and quiet dissent from AIDS activists. That year, he began by funding ACT UP and AMFAR and leading AIDS activists like Kramer and Martin Delaney. NIAID funneled extravagant annual public education grants to advocacy groups. The funding effectively muted their criticisms of Dr. Fauci. The AIDS establishment, hospitals, medical and research centers, and pharmaceutical companies created opulently paid consulting contracts for important members of gay organizations. The gay community thereby became powerful gatekeepers for the AIDS establishment. Other political, economic, and ideological rationales helped Dr. Fauci recruit gay community leaders to his campaign to build a cancel culture against Duesberg and drown out his voice in the liberal mainstream press. In an era when Christian conservatism was so powerful that it credibly claimed to have put Ronald Reagan in the White House, ideology and medical opinions attributing the gay disease to orgies and excess partying tended to feed anti-gay bigotry. The gay community, therefore, happily endorsed Dr. Fauci's one-bug theory. There were compelling mercantile drivers as well. During the 1970s, the principal financial supports of the gay press were ads for the $50 million a year pauper industry and for the bars that flourished on pauper sales. As Ian Young explains in The Pauper's Story, The Rise and Fall and Rise of the Gay Drug in Steam, during the 70s and early 80s, much of the gay press, including the most influential glossy publications, came to rely on Pauper's ads for a huge chunk of its revenue, and Pauper's became an accepted part of gay sex. There was even a comic strip called Pauper's by Jerry Mills. The unwritten agreement was almost never breached. Pauper's ads appeared only in gay publications. The gay press glossed over urgent medical warnings from scientists about the dangers of Pauper's. The Advocate, a popular U.S. magazine for homosexuals, refused to print letters from dissident scientists like Duesberg while accepting parades of Pauper's advertisements from Great Lakes Products, the era's largest manufacturer of sex drugs. Those advertisements exonerated Pauper's from any connection to AIDS, openly declaring them harmless. Pharmaceutical companies, including Hoffman LaRoche, invested money in the gay community with innumerable advertisements for AIDS medications. Burroughs Wellcome ran an ad for Pauper's calling amyl nitrite, i.e. Pauper's, the real thing. Gay publications and organizations continued to promote Pauper's and censure stories about their health risks. His historical cultivation of relationships with gay leaders was one of the factors that made Dr. Fauci a darling of liberals during the early COVID crisis. Numerous other historical and personal factors induced liberals to accept Dr. Fauci without scrutiny. Blind faith in St. Anthony Fauci may go down in history as the fatal flaw of contemporary liberalism and the destructive force that subverted American democracy, our constitutional government, and global leadership. Deadly viruses and mycoplasma. As the HIV/AIDS hypothesis came under attack for its many discrepancies and internal contradictions, scientists besides Duisberg were discovering bugs that provided more plausible culprits in the AIDS pandemic. Among those competing hypotheses were two advanced individually by Robert Gallo and Luc Montagnier. It's probable that diplomacy, self-interest, and honed survival instincts prompted both men to introduce their pathogens as cofactors that might work alongside HIV to trigger AIDS. Critics pointed out that the new pathogens these scientists uncovered were so clearly deadly on their own that they hardly needed HIV. The discovery of these genuinely lethal germs made HIV superfluous and redundant to explaining the pandemic. But for these gentlemen, it was obligatory to genuflect to the inviolable orthodoxy that anointed HIV as AIDS' ultimate cause. They may, in fact, have seen their discoveries as salvatory of the original HIV hypothesis. It was becoming increasingly challenging to credibly claim that HIV, which remained dormant for decades within its host, could somehow suddenly become virulent, the most deadly disease in history, without some external provocation. HHV6. In 1986, Robert Gallo announced the discovery of human herpes virus, HHV6. This new pathogen was no benign retrovirus. It was instead a savage, cell-killing DNA virus. Gallo's lab had found the murderous HHV6 killer cells in the blood of AIDS-infected men and in patients suffering from chronic fatigue syndrome, CFS, an immune deficiency disease extremely similar to AIDS that had appeared in heterosexuals on the exact same timeline as AIDS appeared in homosexuals. Many critics already suspected the two diseases were one and the same. Gallo's discovery seemed to fortify that supposition. In a 1995 article titled Human Herpes Virus 6 in AIDS, Gallo says HHV6 may act as an accelerating factor in HIV infection because HHV6 can also infect and kill CD8+ T cells, natural killer cells, and mononuclear phagocytes, all major components of the immune system. Ironically, Gallo's discovery of HHV6 might have won him the Nobel Prize if he hadn't jumped the gun a decade earlier by stealing HIV from Montagnier. None of the embarrassing questions about how in the world the seemingly benign HIV retrovirus could cause deadly disease bedeviled his lethal new killing machine. While HIV was never shown to be cytocidal, HHV6 had a murderous affinity for CD4 and T-cell in potential effects on the immune system and brains. Gallo declared that HHV6 was a major source of disease progression in AIDS. On May 11, 1988, the Miami Herald reported Gallo's announcement. A newly discovered highly contagious herpes virus might play a role in causing several types of cancer and could be a cofactor in wiping out the immune systems of AIDS patients, one of the nation's premier virologists, Robert Gallo, said Tuesday. The Herald also wrote, "Since the AIDS virus kills only a small percentage of T4 cells at a time, Gallo said the new herpes virus, HHV6, if proven to be the cofactor, could explain the total annihilation of T4 cells in AIDS patients. The virus kills cells after using them to replicate, he says. The Herald quotes Gallo as saying, "So if a co-cofactor is involved in the development of AIDS, and I'm not convinced it's absolutely needed, then we want to consider this one strongly." Charles Ortlieb told me that Gallo's study struck me as being backwards. If Gallo's new DNA virus explains the total annihilation of T4 cells, why would it need a cofactor? The cofactor in this mystery would have to be HIV, not HHV6. Some scientists had similar reservations. HHV6 didn't seem to need a retrovirus wingman. Duisberg remarked dryly that to the extent that Gallo's newly discovered pathogen was partnering with HIV, then HHV6 was the senior partner in the collaboration. I can't help wondering if it occurred then to Gallo that if only he had not impetuously stolen Montagnier's discovery 4 years earlier, he might have collected his long-sought Nobel for his own authentic discovery of a much more plausible AIDS virus. Alas, it was not to be. But Dr. Fauci had committed his agency to the HIV hypothesis, and Gallo had built his career on HIV, even if he stole it from Montagnier, says Charles Ortlieb. When Gallo began that battle with Fauci, says Ortlieb, the agency was already fully committed to the HIV theory and could not afford any signs of retreat. I asked, why would Gallo not pull rank? Ortlieb answered, Gallo is a classic sociopath. He knows that his survival means acquiescing to Fauci. Following Gallo's Natural Killer Cells article, other researchers confirmed the links between HHV6 and AIDS. In 1996, Constance Knox, Ph.D., and Donald R. Kerrigan, Ph.D., published a study demonstrating that 100% of HIV-infected patients studied, 10 out of 10, had active human herpes virus 6A infections in their lymph nodes early in the course of their disease. This finding led Knox and Kerrigan to conclude that active HHV6 infections appear relatively early in the course of HIV disease, and in vitro studies suggest that HHV6 is capable of breaking HIV latency, with the potential for helping to catalyze the progression of HIV infection to AIDS. In April 1986, Dr. Knox stated in an interview with the New York Native, "We're finding HHV6 in the lymph nodes, early active infection. This virus is replicating. This is unheard of for any other opportunistic infection, even TB. Knox said she believed that HIV kind of acts as a wet nurse to HHV6A. Knox and Kerrigan found that every AIDS patient had active replication of HHV6A in every stage of AIDS, from their diagnosis to their autopsies, with many having CD4 plus cell counts over 700. With HHV6A, there were none of the bewildering questions about how a seemingly benign retrovirus could possibly cause all that carnage. It's also much more destructive. It kills very well, and it destroys tissue very well. It can infect the brain, the lungs, the lymphoid organs, and the bone marrow." When New York Native interviewer Nina Ostrom asked Knox, "Can HHV6A do everything that HIV can do?" Knox gave this chilling answer. "As far as immunologic damage, oh, HHV6A does it much more efficiently than HIV." Citing data from multiple studies by diverse scientists, Knox added, "Where we have seen HHV6A in tissue, we see dead tissue. And where you see HIV alone, you don't see dead tissue. You don't see destroyed organs and scar formation. And that's what you see when you see HHV6A. We find replacement of the normal architecture of the lymph nodes with scar tissue. HHV6A kills it. It kills the lymph node tissue." Knox parroted the obligatory language that HHV6 was acting in concert with HIV. That language would preserve her from reputational and financial suicide. "I think they're a team," she said. "And when the two of them are present, they induce the production of more of each other. It's a mutually enhancing relationship. It's our feeling that if you could interrupt or limit or suppress the HHV6A infection, the levels of HIV would go down tremendously, and HIV would become just a chronic viral infection. We don't have any evidence looking in the tissue that HIV is responsible for any of the destruction. And if you think about it, HIV infects patients for years, a decade or more, without progressing to AIDS. When you look in their tissues, you have to ask how you can have such a long-term viral infection and have no damage." NIH quickly cut off funding for Knox and for anyone else who wanted to research HHV6. When Nina Ostrom asked, "Why can't you get more funding for this research?" Knox replied, "Well, I don't know if you've been tracking the kinds of exposés that Science Magazine and others have published, that 80% of AIDS research monies are retained within the federal government programs on AIDS research. I think the science is very inbred, and I think there's been a real resistance to entertaining hypotheses or directions of AIDS research that aren't looking specifically at HIV, and that is the basic problem. Our studies themselves have been enthusiastically received, but the funding hasn't followed. And that is funding through the federal agencies, like the NIH. That summer, Italian researcher Dario De Luca published his findings in the Journal of Clinical Microbiology, reporting HHV6 in the lymph nodes of 22% of chronic fatigue syndrome patients and only 4% of healthy people. This research raised the possibility that AIDS, which affects gay men, is the same disease as CFS, which became widespread in heterosexuals and in virtual lockstep with AIDS in the early 1980s. Surveys of CFS patient groups in 35 states show an exponential rise in cases produced each year since the 1970s. This curious temporal and case production relationship with the AIDS epidemic prompted many researchers to characterize CFS as an AIDS epiphenomenon. Gallo's discovery and Knox's revelations suggested that the new human herpes virus, HHV6, might be a critical causative cofactor shared by both AIDS and CFS. In June 1989, CFS research pioneer Dr. Paul Chaney, Ph.D., M.D., testified before Congress that CFS might have a relationship with the AIDS epidemic. In January 1993, 6 months after the Amsterdam conference, Dr. Anthony Komaroff at Harvard University and his co-workers published a study that showed that brain lesions developed in CFS patients who had human herpes virus 6 active in their bodies. Such revelations could only have terrified Tony Fauci. Ever since the 1992 Amsterdam meeting, Dr. Fauci had been insisting that CFS was a psychosomatic disease. The suggestion that it might be related to AIDS threatened the entire HIV paradigm. In their 1988 Natural Killer Cells paper, Lusso and Gallo had quietly disclosed that they had found HHV6 was infecting and killing NK cells in both AIDS and CFS patients. "They identified the problem in both sets of patients," said Knox, "so it makes sense that the HHV6A would also be a problem in chronic fatigue syndrome." When Gallo and Lusso conducted a trial treating half their AIDS patients with acyclovir, a remedy against herpes, and half with AZT alone, they found a significant prolongation of life in the patients who had AZT and acyclovir, as opposed to AZT alone. Said Knox, "In laboratory testing, HHV6A is sensitive to acyclovir, so we have a curiosity as well. I mean, that would be pretty dandy, because certainly acyclovir has less toxicity than AZT. And if you're talking about treating healthy people in a clinical trial, you're looking for something that people can take orally. These kinds of findings threaten to derail and discredit Anthony Fauci's entire HIV/AIDS paradigm. What, after all, would be the implications if a mild, off-patent remedy like acyclovir could safely treat AIDS more effectively than Dr. Fauci's expensive pharmacopoeia of deadly chemotherapy poisons? He choked off any further funding for HHV6 research, despite Knox's potentially life-saving discovery of the efficacy of acyclovir against AIDS. Mycoplasma. Dr. Xing Lo, the chief researcher in charge of AIDS programs for the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology, was one of the many researchers baffled by Anthony Fauci's unconventional claim that antibodies, heretofore the signal of a robust immune response, should uniquely with HIV instead be the signal for impending death. That was a bridge too far for Dr. Lo. He took the conventional position that the presence of the antibodies to HIV, far from being a sign of doom, is proof that the body has coped successfully with the virus. There is no good explanation for why and how the virus breaks out of the antibody protection, complained Dr. Lo. I'm not saying that HIV plays no role in AIDS. The data shows a clear correlation with disease. He recited the mandatory disclaimer, but AIDS is much more complicated than HIV. In 1986, Dr. Lo announced that he had detected a previously unknown organism in cells taken from AIDS patients. Dr. Lo said that he believed the new organism, a bacterium-like creature known as a mycoplasma, worked with HIV to cause AIDS. Dr. Lo could not find the organism in any healthy individuals. When he injected his mycoplasma into four silvered leaf monkeys, three quickly developed low-grade fevers. All four lost weight and then died between 7 and 9 months of infection. During autopsy, Dr. Lo found mycoplasma in their brains, livers, and spleens. That does not happen with HIV. Dr. Lo also found the mycoplasma, dubbed Mycoplasma incognitus, in the damaged tissue of 6 HIV-negative human beings, perhaps CFS sufferers, who had died with suppressed immune systems after suffering from suspiciously AIDS-like symptoms. For nearly 3 years, mainstream medicine and the captive mainstream and science media dutifully ignored Dr. Lo's research. A dozen scientific journals turned down Xing Lo's studies for publication before the Journal of Tropical Medicine agreed to print his findings. Despite his impressive credentials and his prestigious post as a top military scientist, Dr. Lo's attempts to find funding failed. Dr. Lo's research posed a unique annoyance for Dr. Fauci. Because he was a top military doctor with his own laboratory, he could not be easily dismissed, bullied, or defunded. Then, in December 1989, Dr. Fauci opted to meet this threat from the military with a direct frontal assault. NIAID dispatched a dozen of Dr. Fauci's most skeptical specialists to investigate Dr. Lo's data. Dr. Fauci flew his leading experts in AIDS and other infectious diseases to San Antonio, Texas for the confrontation, expecting to obliterate Dr. Lo and to discredit his theory. Dr. Fauci's panel members quizzed Dr. Lo mercilessly for 3 days before surrendering to the conclusion that Dr. Lo had made a momentous discovery. The documentation was absolutely solid, said Joseph Tully, head of mycoplasma programs for NIAID. The newly converted NIAID participants formally recommended further study of the link between the mycoplasma and AIDS and experiments with drugs that could kill the new microbe. The recommendation apparently displeased Dr. Fauci. "We have not been pulled into the AIDS programs in any real way," Tully complained in 1990. 35 years after Dr. Lowe's initial announcement, NIAID has still funded no research on Dr. Lowe's mycoplasma hypothesis. At the June 1990 San Francisco AIDS conference, Luc Montagnier made his tectonic announcement that the HIV virus is harmless and passive, a benign virus. He added that he had discovered that HIV only becomes dangerous in the presence of a second organism. He described a tiny bacteria-like bug called a mycoplasma. His laboratory had demonstrated that in culture with his new mycoplasma, HIV becomes a vicious killer. Montagnier declared that he now believes that HIV is a peaceful virus that becomes lethal only when combined with Mycoplasma infertans. As Montagnier spoke, Dr. Sheng Lo sat in the audience, basking in vindication. Dr. Lo's important new ally, Montagnier, the Nobel laureate of AIDS, had independently discovered the same mycoplasma and concluded, like Lo, that it was the primary cause of the immune system collapse known as AIDS. The two had not shared their data. Separately, they had made the same earth-shaking discovery 4 months apart. In April of that year, Montagnier published his findings in Research in Virology, reporting that HIV and the microscopic pathogen react together, causing the body's cells to burst. Even more exciting, he had discovered that in his test tubes, tetracycline stopped the mycoplasma's destruction entirely in its tracks. Montagnier's findings had transformative implications for AIDS treatment. They suggested that AIDS could be effectively treated and demolished with common, patent-expired antibiotics instead of deadly and expensive chemotherapy concoctions. At the San Francisco conference, Dr. Lo was almost the only person in the room who was excited. Of the 12,000 people who attended the conference, only 200 attended Montagnier's talk, and almost half of them exited before he finished. Characteristically, the multi-billion-dollar international research and development establishment opted to ignore his discovery. Peter Duisberg said, "There was Montagnier, the Jesus of HIV, and they threw him out of the temple." Who were these people who are so much wiser, so much smarter than Luc Montagnier, asks Harry Rubin, the dean of American retrovirology. He became an outlaw as soon as he started saying that HIV might not be the only cause of AIDS. When asked for an interview concerning Dr. Lowe's work, NIAID Director Anthony Fauci said through spokesperson Mary Jane Walker that he will not talk about mycoplasma or any other AIDS cofactor. In a film interview with Brent Leung in 2006, Tony Fauci said, "Cofactors are not necessary. The data that indicate that any different type of infection, like mycoplasma or something like that, is a necessary cofactor, I believe those theories have been debunked." As usual, Dr. Fauci never cited the study that debunked the work of America's top military AIDS researcher or the Nobel laureate who discovered HIV. 34 years later, with over $500 billion spent on AIDS research, Dr. Fauci has not budgeted $1 to study the role of Lowe's and Montagnier's mycoplasma or Ingallo's and Knox's HHV6 virus in the etiology of AIDS. Between 1981 and 2020, U.S. taxpayers alone shelled out $640 billion for AIDS research, focused almost exclusively on developing drugs to address Dr. Fauci's sketchy HIV hypothesis. Yet the growing list of medications hasn't demonstrably extended the life of a single patient, and the cure for AIDS is still nowhere in sight. The minute someone suggests that the orthodoxy might be wrong, the establishment starts to call him crazy or a quack, Rubin continued. 1 week you're a great scientist, the next week you're a jerk. Science has become the new Church of America and is closing off all room for creative, productive dissent. After suggesting in print 2 years earlier that HIV might need a cofactor to cause AIDS, Gallo went dark. Gallo today refuses to discuss the matter. The normally loquacious and combative Gallo refused my request to talk about HHV6. AIDS and fear. In a rational universe, or in a functioning democracy, combatants would duke out the incendiary HIV-AIDS dispute in an open public debate in the scientific literature between the foremost establishment scientists and the best credentialed dissenting ones. But in Tony Fauci's authoritarian technocracy, the ruling medical cabal refuses to allow this sort of dialogue. Like Inquisition priests, HIV's high clergy stubbornly resist the possibility that they might be wrong. From the outset, the HIV-AIDS religion has seen its survival in moral absolutism, outright discrimination, and merciless suppression of doubt. Dr. Harvey Bealey argues that the medical establishment's top concern is not public health, but their own reputations and perquisites. The scientific and medical communities have a great deal of face to lose. It is not much of an exaggeration to state that when the HIV-AIDS hypothesis is finally recognized as wrong, the entire institution of science will lose the public's trust, and science itself will experience fundamental, profound, and long-lasting changes. The scientific community has risked its credibility by standing by the HIV theory for so long. This is why doubting the HIV hypothesis is now tantamount to doubting science itself, and this is why dissidents face excommunication. As Carey Mullis says in his book, Dancing Naked in the Mind Field, what people call science today is probably very similar to what was called science in 1634. Galileo was told to recant his beliefs or be excommunicated. People who refuse to accept the commandments of the AIDS establishment are basically told the same thing. The quasi-religious nature of the debate is evident in the loathing and pious moralizing expressed toward Duisburg by an unnamed Berkeley scientist interviewed by Celia Farber for her 2006 book, Serious Adverse Events, An Uncensored History of AIDS. He did it to himself, you know. You see, he wouldn't give up an idea. He went at it with a hammer. He may well be 3,000% right, but he upset an awful lot of people. Nobody believed in him because what he was doing was overturning generally held views. They felt betrayed. You don't just stand up and say everybody is wrong. In her book, Science Sold Out, Does HIV Really Cause AIDS?, Rebecca Colshaw writes, "The persistence of this intellectually bankrupt theory in the public mind is attributable entirely to the campaign of fear, discrimination, and terror that has been waged aggressively by a powerful group of people whose sole motivation was and is behavior control. Yes, the money and the vast interests of the pharmaceutical industry and government-funded scientists are important, but the seeds of the HIV-AIDS hypothesis are sowed with fear. If the fear were to end, the myth would end." Please go to the Children's Health Defense website for the acknowledgments and notes by chapter, updates to data, and new information that becomes available on any of the subject matter covered in this audiobook.